You are listening to the Chaotic Punk News Podcast number 380. Welcome back to the Punk News Podcast. We're starting 15 minutes late because, as always, things are in a state of calamity at Punk News, a whirling ball of chaos and destruction to mirror the state of the world, to mirror the state of the music world as well. Things are chaos. Features editor Adam White is here with me. Adam White, things are falling apart, man. Falling apart.
It's really Microsoft's fault, John. That's, I mean, like most things.
Who you think is more evil? Gates or Steve Jobs?
I mean, Gates released all those mosquitoes into a room during a TED Talk, which is Oh, didn't you know that supervillain thing that he did? I mean, normally these guys are evil because they're invading our privacy or you know, updating Skype when we're not sure if they're supposed to be updating Skype. But no, Gates was doing a malaria talk. It may have been a TED Talk, or and he was at some institution talking to a bunch of like enlightened young people, and he had this box of malaria mosquitoes at the front of the room, and then in the middle of his talk, he just opened it and let out the mosquitoes, and then like kept doing his talk to kind of prove a point. But then I think at the end of the talk, he revealed that they weren't actually malaria mosquitoes, but he still released mosquitoes into a room full of people. So that's kind of evil.
See, I think that's pre-punk rock. It's like the Butthole Surfers show at Lollapalooza, where Gibby Haynes would come out with a shotgun and fire it at people, even though it was blanks. Or the guy from the Feeders would come out with the machine gun and fire blanks at people. I respect Bill Gates for that. Tricky Ricky.
Yeah.
Who's more evil, Steve Jobs or Bill Gates?
I was going to say Zuckerbot, but...
Zuckerbot. Good answer.
And also, and just one thing. Just because my Skype isn't working doesn't mean things aren't falling around me. Los Angeles is on fire in two different places, and when I woke up, it looked like Armageddon. So it was cold and smoky today. So I don't know. Maybe it's the end is starting, John.
Ricky, can you put things in perspective here? I have a Skype problem. No one cares about your fires or whatever the fuck is happening in Los Angeles.
Well, Bad Religion called it.
The world is in a state of chaos, so I'm glad we've got two very special guests here to bring some peace, some order, some reflection, some introspection, some artful discussion to the Punk News Podcast. We are here with Kiri Oliver and Heidi Vanderlei of the band Early Riser. Kiri and Heidi, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for being on.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And, you know, we're going to interview them and we're going to have them be on the news. But before we do that, let's play an Early Riser tune. Heidi, Kiri and Heidi, what tune should we play?
We think that you should play Oh Nevermind.
This is Oh Nevermind off their new album by Early Riser, which you can get off Bandcamp.com.
We'll be right back.
and that was Oh Nevermind by Early Riser. So here we are, Kiri Oliver, Heidi Vanderlei. I know you guys are in, Kiri and Heidi are in a very interesting band, Early Riser. What's interesting about them is there's two of them. Heidi mainly handles the cello and vocals, and Kiri, you, I guess you do like guitar and vocals, right?
Yeah, and on the record, I played piano as well.
So I mean, like, was there a tactical decision to say, we're going to do a band with an unusual setup, or is that just how it came out?
Just what we play. It's just the instruments that we play.
Yeah, I literally don't know how to play another instrument.
You guys, before you guys were in Early Riser, you were in another band together, and you guys also did Permanent Wave, which was kind of, a punk booking show organization. Is that correct?
Yeah,
that's correct. We met in, 2011?
Mm-hmm. So tell me about Permanent Wave, because it was a pretty cool thing, or is a cool thing.
Yeah, and it was a feminist collective that, it did a bunch of things, but what we mainly worked on was booking benefit shows for different organizations that help women and girls, largely with female-fronted bands. And that was really fun. We used to do them a lot at Death by Audio and a lot of venues that no longer exist in Brooklyn, but they were super supportive of us and, you know, built up a really cool community of like-minded people and bands, many of whom we're still friends with today.
What are some of the cooler bands that you guys booked or cooler shows that you saw there?
It was crazy because we booked a lot of bands that now are kind of like bananas big. Like, we booked Priest at a really little venue. There's this venue called Big Snow Buffalo Lodge, and we did actually like a 3-day festival at one point, and called Permanent Wave Fest. And we booked, and there was this tiny club that used to be like it was kind of a coke den. It used to be a coke den, and then they turned it into a club, an all ages club, and priests played there. And it was basically like you had to walk past the stage to get to the bathroom, and it was not big, and the guys that ran it were super nice and like always let us book shows there. We also we did a show at Death by Audio that was a benefit for Pussy Riot, and we had a lot of great guests. We had Heliotropes, who are no longer a band, and actually Ad Rock DJ'd that show.
Whoa.
Yeah, that was crazy. There was like this line out the door because Ad Rock was there. And so we all danced on stage with Ad Rock wearing balaclavas.
That was one of the crazier moments of my life, wearing a neon ski mask on stage with my audio while Ad Rock DJ'd. I'll never forget that.
And he was the best. He was super nice. And we just had, we had a great time with those shows. And we would always make sure because, you know, at the time we were going to and playing a lot of shows where it was just like, you know, three bands of four white dudes and us. And we would be like, this is boring. There has to be something more interesting out there, you know?
And then you guys were a band together that came apart, but you guys were both in the band, right? So I believe Kiri already had Early Riser kind of going, and then Heidi, you joined, right? And then you guys kind of solidified.
Yeah, I mean, Early Riser was a solo project that I did sporadically, and it kind of was on hold while we were in this other band together, Lita. But as soon as the band broke up, we had this really nice practice space that we just got, and we didn't want to stop playing together. So we said, okay, why don't we just come back here next week? And I said, do you want to write some cello parts for my solo stuff? Because for some reason, I had always had that in mind, like that my solo songs would have strings on them. And some of the riffs were already written and stuff. And we just started working on those and adding harmonies and went from there, writing more stuff together.
I was reading an interview with you two, and you guys talked about cello riffs. Heidi, I never thought of the cello as a riff instrument. Tell me about writing a riff on the cello.
Usually Kiri sings something at me and then I try and play it. Or sometimes I'll come up with it. Like, I've played cello on a lot of records for other people. And I mean, I was in a band too, where, my cello and the guitar were kind of the two lead instruments. Like, I would sort of solo along with the lead guitarist in our other band. So I learned how to just play as a lead instrument rather than like when I would play on people's records, I was usually more of a decoration a little bit. Like, you know, people would be like, oh, we just want some like pretty string parts here. And like, you know, it'd be more texture than an actual solo instrument. But like I said, it's literally the only instrument I know how to play. and I don't want to play background parts in my own band, so that's why I write riffs. And Kiri writes them a lot too. She'll just, like I said, she'll sing them at me, and then I will play them because I'm pretty good at playing stuff by ear. So that's how that goes.
Do you feel the cello is an underappreciated instrument? Does it not? I mean, everybody talks about guitar, bass. Does the cello not get due props?
I think it is appreciated in the wrong way. I think, no, I'm serious. Kiri's laughing at me. I think it's appreciated in the wrong way. I think people usually think like, oh, cello is something that just is very like soft and pretty and like, you know, it's just sort of one dimensional. And like, whenever you see a band with a cellist, it's usually more of a gimmick or an afterthought. I'm not trying to like talk crap on anyone. I'm just saying like it usually when we play a show, the sound guy will just be kind of like surprised that I know what I'm doing and that I'm a functional part of the band.
Oof, most sound people have never worked with the cello before and don't know what to do with it.
Yeah. So I think that, I don't know. Cello is awesome. You can, and I don't even do what I could do with it. Like I have all these pedals and stuff that I haven't figured out yet.
Yeah, next record, man. We're going to do some crazy stuff. We'll figure it out.
There's steel strings. You can do whatever you like. You can do all kinds of stuff with a cello sound that you could do with a guitar. Just the player has to know what they're doing, which I don't know yet.
Now, Kiri, one of early Riser songs is a song called Find Me for a Waltz. And I think the gist of the song is it's a song about someone who you thought they were someone and they weren't actually that person, but you decided to have a good time anyways. Roughly, did I get that about right?
Yeah, like having someone in the scene that you kind of put on a pedestal and then you're at a show realizing that you're feeling disappointed by them and you're just like, screw it, I'm at this show, I'm seeing a band that I love. Actually, we were talking about World Inferno Friendship Society before we went on air, and I wrote it sort of in my head over a series of two World Inferno shows I was at feeling very sad. And so there are some references that fans of that band may get in the lyrics. But yeah, that's the gist.
I had no idea about that. I'll have to go back and reassess. I do know World Inferno waltzes at their show often. I'll have to go back and think about that. The point being is, it seems to me that a lot of your songs are very personal and introspective. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely.
Do you ever fear or do you ever have problems with revealing too much, like giving away too much or letting people too much inside your head or diary or however you want to phrase it?
That's a good question. I mean, I write a lot of songs and most of them no one ever hears. So if I write something super personal that I really feel is just for me and I don't want to share it, then I don't have to share it, you know, because songwriting, it is for me as much as it is to share with anyone else. You know, most of what I've written has been kind of a process of working through my feelings about something, even though I'm never going to like put it on a record. So it's definitely something I think about, like how much do I want to share and in what kind of a direct way do I want to share it? I like writing in a way that comes from personal experience, but is still going to be relatable to a lot of people, even if they haven't had the exact same experience, that they can connect to something in the feelings or the lyrics that reminds them of something they've been through.
Heidi and Kiri and Heidi, why do you think when I listen to your record, what I like about it is it really does gel together. It really has a unique sound. It really feels as though you both are on the same level. I was speaking to Jared of Screaming Females once, and he said to me, with Guns N' Roses, the reason that the outros are like a minute and a half long is because everyone's trying to get the last word, either the last drum solo, the last guitar, the last, you know. And if you listen to Guns N' Roses songs, the outro is as long as the song itself. You two, it seemed like you're on the same level. You're jiving. Do you guys really jive well? And if so, why? Or is there a lot of fighting behind the scenes?
At this point, if we didn't like each other, I think we would have figured it out.
Yeah.
But I very much like being compared to Guns N' Roses. they actually played all of Appetite for Destruction. You were at a show that we played in Philly recently, and they played. Oh, no, it wasn't there. I'm sorry. In Asbury Park, they played all of Appetite for Destruction after we got off stage, and it made me really happy. That said, it's pretty understood what our roles are. I think Kiri writes the songs. I don't know how to write a song. But I do know how to write parts and harmonies. So Kiri writes the song. I write some other stuff. We sometimes disagree about exactly how that should go, but we usually find a common ground. We both, I mean, we're not, there's not really any sort of outside force telling us what anything should sound like. So it's really just between the two of us. And luckily, we've been pretty much on the same page. Although I don't know, Kiri could decide that she wants to include throat singing in our next record, in which case I would immediately quit the band.
We've been listening to a lot of WFMU?
WFMU is my favorite radio station of all time, but they have a throat singing show, and I have a personal problem with it.
What's next for you guys? You guys got a new record? You got? I know there's some tour dates, I think, in February, March, or something like that.
We're just taking December off and going to start writing some new stuff. Although the two of us are here and usually represent the band in interviews and stuff, we always play as a four piece. So the drummer and bassist that we're playing with right now, we're going to start working on some new songs with them, which will be fun. And, just getting in order what we want to do next year. Not really sure yet. Definitely want to do, some more touring in whatever way we're able. Get to some new places.
Go up north.
Yeah, I want to go north. We've gone south a couple times, but we haven't played Connecticut, Boston, or north of that.
I want to go to Toronto.
Yeah, Toronto's cool.
I'm excited. I've seen Early Riser live. It's a unique show. It's really, I saw them open for Sneakers Award, which is Brian McGee of Plow Unite. Oh, I got to ask you guys, Joel Tannenbaum, yeah. Longtime punk news homie. You guys are down with the Joel Tannenbaum, aren't you?
We sure are. Big fan.
Listen, has Joel been distant lately? I realize this is a private conversation, but I feel as though the guy's been kind of distracted. You know what I mean? Is it me or is it him? That's what I want to know. I want to know, should I continue my friendship with Joel or should I let it drift away? That's the question.
He would hate this so much, which makes me delighted. I don't know. I mean, if he wants, we talk about TV a lot. I don't know.
Yeah.
I talk to Joel pretty much every day. It's just not always about music. He is interested in what is going on with us and our band. He always asks us how our shows have gone. Just for your listeners, the relationship is that Joel is our friend, and I played on some of the Rentiers records, and he also produced our record, which was an excellent experience. And he's just sort of like, I don't know, he's like our cheerleader and our friend. And I think he seems to be right now very into championing other people's musical projects.
Really? Because when I talk to him, I'm like, hey, Joel, check out this band. He's like, oh, I don't really care about music anymore. Well listen, I think we know the deal. I think we know the deal.
He texted me the other day asking what he should listen to at the gym.
Me too.
Yeah, you guys know this band, The Coat Hangers. I'm a big fan of this band, The Coat Hangers. I said, Joel, check out this band, The Coat Hangers. He's like, oh, I don't really listen to new music anymore. Well, listen, I guess we see how it is. Listen, another interesting thing about Kiri and Heidi, they are the music bookers for the Chris Gethard show.
Yes,
and I'm also
okay,
sorry.
That's really cool. Okay, that's really, I love that. That's great.
So,
our friend Zane, the three of us have been the bookers for the Gethard show since 2012, back in the ye olde public access days, all the way from that to two seasons on Fusion to True TV. We just wrapped up 16 episodes of our new season, and we're coming back in the spring for 10 more.
Well, I know we're definitely excited about that. What are some of, I guess, the more memorable guests or more memorable performances that you guys have booked for the show?
It's so hard because there's so many. Like, almost every band that's played on the show has been a wonderful, memorable experience. And usually if it's not wonderful or memorable, it's because, I don't know, that hasn't happened in a long time. I think that, like, back when we first started booking on public access, there were definitely some communication breakdowns where all of us were like, what are we all doing here? this season, I think the three of us were talking about how this season, I think we think this is maybe the best season we've ever booked in terms of diversity, getting who we wanted, and also what not only the network and the show staff liked, but also the reaction that we got from our audience, because they're, you know, that's who we book for. We book for our audience because we think it's someone that they'll like. We had this amazing rapper on this season called Nitty Scott that Zane was into, and I don't think anyone really knew what to expect. And she just came on with like her three backup dancers and blew everyone's mind, and it was so fun. We also, who else did we have this season that was?
Oh, so many good bands. We had a couple old punk crowd favorites. Oh, we had Less Than Jake and Adam and His Package. Both just like so, so fun for me personally and for a lot of people on the show to have. As well as Warriors, Cayetana, Mannequin Pussy. We wrapped up this stretch of episodes with this band called The Skins, more of like a R&B rock, different genres type band. They're pretty young. They're really, really incredible, and they blew people away. So it's been really fun to like mix up bands that we know a lot of the fans like with ones that we know they probably haven't heard of. But once they see them, they're going to be like, oh my God, this band is amazing. It's just so fun to be able to like bring bands to an audience of people who love music and want to dance in the studio and want to check out new bands.
What I really like about you guys, and feel free to disagree with my premise or agree with my premise, is the variety and range of bands you guys bring is really awesome and sometimes very unexpected. Like, no one would expect Nightbirds to be on or any number of different acts. It's so much more exciting to me than seeing, I'm not trying to diss, but like, it's like, here's the Foo Fighters, you know, here's Chainsmokers.
We never booked the Foo Fighters. Well, we couldn't afford the Foo Fighters, but we also never would book the Foo Fighters. No offense, Dave Grohl. I'm sure you're very nice. Well, it's funny you mentioned Nightbirds. We actually hadn't started booking yet. And that episode was the first live episode we ever attended, that or Ted Leo. I'm trying to remember.
And bonkers.
Nightbirds like actually were so rowdy that Shannon got mad at them, and that was like one of our first experiences with the show.
Well, they brought like 40 of their own fans, and they moshed, and they almost broke the cameras
that were not ours. And yeah, and I remember we were just like, "What have we done? What have we done? What are we doing? Why are we doing this?" But then it ended up being great, and like some of the bands that we got on Public Access, like looking back, I still can't believe we did that. We had no money. Literally no money.
Yeah, like real estate approached us and they're like, can we play on the show? And we're like, what? Yes.
Sure. We had Craig Finn play solo on Public Access. Franz, too.
Mike Doughty,
yeah. And who else? We had Sleater Kinney do their first in-person interview.
When they got back together?
When they got back together. That was insane.
Yeah.
This was, you have to understand, like, I don't know if you ever went to Public Access for the Gethard show, but it is zero budget. Like, Chris kept the whole set in his the trunk of his car. Like, we had no money at all, and you know, we used to have to physically drive bands to the studio to make them be on the show, like
in like 59th Street and 11th Avenue or whatever.
Yeah, the middle of nowhere in Manhattan, a place no one would ever go.
Yeah, I mean, before working on the show, I really had no concept of like really what Public Access was or that it could be good. And like, Zane looped us into this world because he had played on the show a couple times with his other bands, but I really had no idea what to expect. And at the time, like, most people, I would think, wouldn't have expected that there would be, like, good bands on Public Access or, like, have it be, like, a destination that you'd want to go to. So it was really, really cool to start bringing so many bands on that bands got excited about the idea of playing on a Public Access show. Like, that is a rare thing.
Well, listen, people, you guys have got to watch the Chris Gethard show. The bands are awesome. The topics are awesome. It's a very unique show. It's on True TV. You also need to check out Early Riser. And honestly, there's a lot I want to talk about you guys more with, but we got to get to the news. So maybe we'll have you back on again, because one of the main things I want to talk to you guys about is, Heidi was talking about this, there's kind of a modern version of payola now that all the magazines want people to write for free. Isn't that right, Heidi?
Oh, you were looking at my Twitter, weren't you?
I was. But listen, let's leave him in suspense. We'll talk about that next time you guys are on, but let's get to some news. How about that?
Cool. Sounds good.
So listen, people, and actually, this is quite fitting that Early Riser here, because this is relates to them to a degree. I've been banging on this guy for about a year and a half now. We've been following, actually, this fits with them perfectly twice, and here's why, but we'll get to it. We've been banging on poor Martin Shkreli for about 2 years now, a year and a half. In part because he bought the world's most expensive record, Wu-Tang's Once Upon a Time in Shaolin. That was only a single copy was pressed, and RZA sold it to Martin Shkreli for, I think it was $2 million. About a month ago, Shkreli appeared to sell on eBay for $1 million, meaning it dropped in value. Meanwhile, Shkreli also is in jail for 3 counts of securities fraud. He's awaiting sentencing, but the reason he's not out on bail is because he put a thing out on Twitter that said, grab Hillary Clinton's hair and I'll pay you a bunch of money. So the judge thought he was violating the terms of his release at the time. So now he's in the slammer. And so now that he's in the slammer, now that he's been convicted of three counts of securities fraud, the government is seeking to execute via post-asset execution due to fraud. Basically, when you commit fraud, the government is allowed to seize assets that you gained related to that fraud, and actually other assets too. It's kind of a hot topic with regards to the justice system and politics and that kind of a thing. As part of the court's post-asset execution, the prosecutors have asked for a mysterious Wu-Tang album, Once Upon a Time in Shaolin, or the proceeds of the sale of If It's Been Sold, as well as The Carter 5 by Lil Wayne, which has not yet been released. So the story of this record is insane. Wu-Tang said, we're going to sell a single copy of this record. A mysterious buyer bought it for $2 million. It was Martin Shkreli. He threatened to destroy it. Then he sold it on eBay. Then he went to jail. And now the court is asking for it back in order to resell it. The trials and trips and tales of this record is amazing. The weird thing is, or not the weird thing, but the interesting thing is, Kiri knew Martin Shkreli at least years ago. Kiri, we've been bashing on this guy pretty hard. Are we wrong to be on him? Is there humanity in there that we're missing out on?
I mean, I think his actions speak for themselves and he can be judged on those. I met Martin in like 2002 in the emo scene, and we went to a lot of shows together for, I would say, like about like 2009. We only ever talked about music. I knew that he worked in like hedge funds and he had money and stuff. He was kind of like a hedge fund prodigy. I had no idea about all this other stuff. It was news to me as well when it came out with the price gouging and the alt-right stuff. I don't even know. It was very interesting.
And didn't you also, because didn't he used to own the label that...
Yep. Yeah. He like basically bankrolled Jeff Rickley's record label at one point. So that sucked when the AIDS drug stuff came out, then, you know, Jeff disavowed him. But I think that I don't know if the label is still around because he basically was the benefactor for it.
Jeff's so nice, too.
I know. I felt so bad about that.
Do you guys think there's humanity under there, or is he just a cretin?
I mean, I think that he is addicted to the attention.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's someone who would have loved to be a frontman of a successful band, but just never went for it. And at one point he said to me, like, I wish I was in a band, but I'm just going to like do business instead. And, you know, he's reached this, in a way, rock star level of infamy doing whatever he does. Yeah.
Well, speaking of rock star levels of infamy, Adam White.
Hold on, John, before you get there, you really have to get into this list of assets that they're trying to acquire from him, because there is some amazing shit on it outside of this Wu-Tang record. So, they're trying to get Once Upon a Time in Shaolin, which is the one that I guess he's famous for acquiring here. There is a copy of The Carter 5 by Lil Wayne that, which is this unreleased Lil Wayne record that he claims to have, but so the government wants it as well. He has, and this is what's amazing for me, a fucking Enigma machine. John, do you know what an Enigma machine is?
I thought that was like something like the Riddler used to like kill Batman or something.
The Enigma machine is the machine that the Nazis used in World War II to coat their messages and send them between places. So like if you ever saw, like, there was a movie years ago called U-571 that was like a submarine movie. It was a movie that basically took the fact that the British cracked the Enigma machine and rewrote it to be like heroic Americans in World War II cracked the Enigma machine. But I'm not sorry about that or anything, but that's what it was about. Or like, what was it called? There was a movie with The Imitation Game, right? Which is, I think, the slightly more historical accurate one that Benedict Cumberbatch was in playing Alan Turing. So like all of those are about like cracking the Enigma machine during World War II. So Martin Shkreli has one of those apparently, which is awesome. And a Picasso painting. So yeah, I'm amazed that this list of things is all together in a single paragraph of a legal document, like a Lil Wayne record, a Wu-Tang record, an Enigma machine, and a Picasso painting. Like, this is something special. I just want to dwell on that.
That's just like, I mean, that's kind of almost stereotypically what you would expect someone to have if they had too much money, right?
Yeah.
Like that's getting on supervillain, right? Like you're acquiring you know, like World War II code breaking machines, all these, you're buying all these like incredibly rare, impossible to get hip hop records just to, I don't know, just to fuck with people.
You have them.
Yeah, it's great. Like, I'd like to know if like they find this Picasso painting and he's just been like tearing small strips out of it. Just because that's what I want, John. You can move on now.
You want to destroy Picasso, Adam?
No, I want to know that Martin Shkreli's been destroying Picasso. Just like, but he'd be doing it like on YouTube on a live stream at like 4 a.m. one day.
Here's what I want.
Whoever happens to be watching one of his weirdo live streams, he's like, I'm going to just destroy this Picasso. That's what I want.
Here's what I want: Martin Shkreli to be in a cell, and then at midnight, the stroke of midnight, a ghost appears. And like, Martin Shkreli, do you remember when you used to want to be in a band? You had such youthful promise. Then another ghost appears. He's like, here you are, Martin Shkreli, in jail while all your friends are out and having fun. And the third ghost appears and gives him a taste of the future. And I want Martin Shkreli to have a Christmas miracle and say, you know what? I might be in a slammer, but I'm going to devote my money and my genius for good from now on. I want a Christmas miracle, Adam.
Someone should write a concept record that's just a Christmas carol, Martin Shkreli edition.
Well, speaking of carols, here's an interesting carol. Tegan and Sarah, they recently wrapped up their Con number 10 tour, the 10th anniversary of the Con, wherein they played the entire Con front to back, live, acoustic only. Interestingly, I saw Tegan and Sarah in 2007 when the album first came out, and they did the entire album back to front, which was interesting. So it was a nice little, circular nod, if you will. Anyways, the very last show in, I think it was Austin. Was it Austin? It was might have been Austin, somewhere around there. Somewhere in Austin, I think. At Austin, Tegan Quinn lost her voice before the very last show. So instead of canceling the show, what the sisters did is they printed up 1,200 books of all the lyrics from the Con, handed it out to the audience. And during the show, Sarah Quinn sang Tegan's lead vocals, where it was mostly Tegan's song, songs where both sisters sang a lot. Sarah sang Sarah's parts, and the audience sang Tegan's part. Meanwhile, longtime Punk News favorite Gabriel McNair of No Doubt and also of Tegan and Sarah sang as well. And I got to say, everybody, I'm interested in anybody's take on this is, you know, a lot of bigger artists, if something goes wrong, they cancel the show. Punk bands, you know, if somebody can't do it, they just go plow through it anyway because it's a punk show. I think this was really, really cool and interesting and special what the sisters did in order to make the show must go on with 1,200 audience members singing through music books. I thought that was pretty cool.
I love that. I've been thinking lately about how I think what fans want, or at least what I know I want as a fan, is like to have an experience. So like those 1,200 people are going to be able to tell that story forever, you know, and they were at a show that was different from every other show. And that's so, so cool. And like if it had been canceled, that would have been such a bummer. And now like they all get to have had that really unique experience together.
Sounds like they recognize how important they are to their fans.
John, do you get like $5 every time you mention Gabriel McNair on this?
No, I just, Heidi and Key might not know this, but about a year ago, basically, Tegan and Sarah said, oh, we've got Gabriel McNair in our band. So I did an article, Gabriel McNair is playing with Tegan and Sarah. And of course, Gabriel McNair is the famous trombone player and trumpet player from No Doubt. He also played on Green Day Records, Offspring Records. And I thought it was just like an innocent little thing that like, oh, this is cool. This guy who did, you know, a lot of hit records or important punk records or pop punk records is now with Tegan and Sarah. Isn't that interesting? But for some reason, the punk new readership like hated the fact that I mentioned Gabriel McNair as anybody whatsoever, and people got enraged. So now I've got sort of I don't know what the word I'm looking for is, but now I enjoy posting Gabriel McNair stories just to annoy people. But I don't want to draw Gabriel McNair into the fight. Like, I genuinely appreciate him, but I don't want to make him a joke. You know what I mean?
I think all the Brooklyn vegan commenters came over to your website.
Well, listen, Gabriel McNair, he's a cool guy. We've got one more story here. This is an Adam White story for sure. Adam White, your main man, the Canadian colossal.
The Winnipeg Warbler. Yeah. Neil Young has released streaming basically his entire discography and a whole bunch of rare stuff and everything that he's ever done, apparently, for free on this website that he's launched. It's this Neil Young Archives site. It is something he's been talking about and working on for years and years and years and years. And it can now, it has now launched. So it exists over at, uh, over at thenealyoungarchives.com. Now, like everything with that Neil has done in the past, I don't know, since like the internet has existed, it's half a genuine, you know, artistic product, and half Neil doing his like get off my lawn old man rant about things. And that really kind of shines through the more that you read about what he's done here. So Neil, if you remember, John, a few years ago, he decided that digital music was not up to snuff as far as Neil goes. And sorry, there's phone bleeping happening. It's John making my phone bleep. That's interesting.
Me?
Yeah, you. Neil, a few years ago, decided that digital audio wasn't really up to snuff for him, so he was going to go create his own thing. So he invented this triangular MP3 player device called the Pono. Remember the Pono?
I remember the Pono.
Do you have a Pono?
I did not, but for Christmas one year, my mom was like, I got you a great present, a Zune. I was like, oh, thanks, Ma. Thanks a lot.
former Punk News video editor, Chris Moran, we were at Punk Rock Bowling once in Las Vegas, and he had one of the brown Zunes, and I was fucking amazed with it, just because it was the brown one, and like, who makes brown electronics in this, you know, half of humanity? Anyways, so Neil Young has gone... Yeah, so he's gone and he's made his Pono, which was his high def audio player, but no one bought one of those, so that was a problem. And he's been alternating between trying to make something and just taking his ball and going home. So I'm sure you know this, John, because you were trying to listen to On the Beach one day and you couldn't, but like, he pulled all of his music off of like Apple Music and all those services and iTunes and everything else at some point last year, and it's all just like slowly crept back on in the past few months. So with this thing, it's not just like a massive free archive of all the Neil Young songs. It's like that / Neil's new tech startup. So he's gone and he's, I guess, used like Neil Young money to build this some streaming audio format that is basically pulling down like CD quality like master recordings shit and playing that, which is great, except that it's incredibly slow if you try to interact with it in that realm. At least it was for me earlier today. I was poking around on this. I'm at my office at work, which, I mean, it's a tech company, so you figure it has a pretty decent internet connection. And I could not get any of this, like, master quality audio to function off of the Neil Young archives. I had to flip the hilarious little animated switch and pull them down as a normal stream. So this is, you know, this is as much a celebration of his stuff as it is him shaking his fist at the current standards in audio fidelity. So I don't know.
Good for Neil. He's not getting pushed around by Steve Jobs. Well, listen, I'm going to do what I want to do, and he's taking control of his music and presenting it the way he wants to present it. Well, good on Neil, I say.
Yeah, I mean, that's I agree. I think this could be an interesting avenue to take if artists hate being paid dog shit by Spotify and Pandora. I mean, you see videos like video content happening like this, where like Netflix or Hulu, you get a you have to pay to get past the paywall. And I'm wondering if this could be a model for bigger bands to be like, all right, you can go onto our website and maybe you can grab our app, but you pay a subscription amount to get our music instead of paying
this album is free or whatever. For now, and then like June 30th or something, it's going to cost something, right? But who knows what that is. I have a hard time in my mind rationalizing like having Neil Young be one of my monthly utility bills.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But like, I think what he's doing is now, right, I guess right now, is he's drawing people in. Hulu was free at one time. He's probably drawing people in. He'll probably put a bunch of new stuff on there, like a few weeks or so, that's a guess of mine. And then he'll draw, you know, what, like a good amount of those people into pay per month to listen.
Whenever I look at one of these things, I'm thinking that like, Neil's fans are going here to interact with Neil's music, but Neil's just using his music as bait to pull you into his cranky old man argument, and that's what he really wants to have.
Yeah, but
so Kieran, like, Kieran Heidi, Neil Young, champion of the people, or drug dealer via the world of music.
I love Neil Young. I mean, I love his music. I, as a person, I lately have not paid a ton of attention, but I do remember reading something about how the Pono was not actually really any better than, because I was interested in that. I remember reading that there, it wasn't actually any better than any other format or device that was out there right now. And like, maybe he believes it is. Maybe he does truly believe that it is, and somebody who works with him told him that it's true, and so he believes it. He can give it a shot. He's rich enough. If it fails, he'll be fine.
What I have to imagine that he's doing is, he, I think he has this expectation that people engage with his music using like all of the best quality things, and it's just like, it's just the internet that's failing him. Because like, if I'm going to go onto the Neil Young archives and pull up like the CD master quality stream or whatever the hell, and then I listen to it through like my MacBook speakers, yeah. I don't know if he's accomplishing anything. And I feel like he's like sort of glossing over the fact that there's generations of people that probably interacted with Neil Young music over like AM radio. So
yeah.
I don't know that. I mean, I love hearing stories about Neil Young being a nut when it comes to audio quality. I mean, I think there's a famous one where like he went out into the middle of a lake in a canoe with I forget who he was with, but it was another famous person, and he had rigged up like two cottages that he, or a cottage and a barn that he has on the shore of this of the lake as two giant speakers essentially. and like blasted music into the middle of the lake where you had to sit in this boat to listen to it via these speakers. Like, that's all super fun. I just feel that, like, you know, I'm in this Neil Young archive thing here, but at some point it's going to like, the music is going to stop and then Neil's going to appear and lecture me. Worried about the lecture, John.
Neil Young is reminding me a lot of my dad in this situation. My dad is a huge audiophile, and that story you just told about the lake sounds like my dad. So
I want to know who he was with. John, I'm going to find this out. Neil Young.
Lake. Well, it's, while Adam's doing research. Is the part
where we Google stuff?
while Adam's doing research, Kiri and Heidi, Heidi and Kiri, thank you for being on the program. Is there anything else you want to mention, anything else you want to talk about? And also, where can people check out your tunage?
Well, thank you, first of all, for having us. We love Punk News. We think it's really cool that y'all have been around for so long and are so, you know, what's the word I'm thinking of? Diligent about covering the scene.
Thank you. Thank you.
Appreciate it. And Kiri, you can get our music on Bandcamp.
Yeah, we have a website now. It's earlyrisermusic.com.
It's very pretty.
Our album came out on vinyl in the summer, and that's available from AF and Anchorless Records, and we're also about to launch our own store shortly with all of our merch. If you like cat pentagrams, that's seems to have become our thing, so check that out.
Well sounds awesome. Listen, I want to have you gals on again maybe in a few months, because I want to talk about, you know, the what's next for Early Riser. I want to talk about this whole payola type thing. And I want to talk about music booking some more. So how about we have you guys on in a little while? How's that sound?
We'd love it.
We'd love it.
Cool. Well, nice talking to you guys, and best wishes, and we'll keep in touch.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, John, here, I'm going to cap it off with your story here. So it was Graham Nash. So Neil Young brings Graham Nash into a rowboat into the water. He's got his house rigged up as the one speaker, the barn rigged up as the other speaker. They blast Harvest, the 1972 record, through this. And then the best part of the story is that at a certain point, Elliot Mazur, who was Neil's producer and produced Harvest, walks down onto the shore from the house and he shouts out to the boat, "How is that, Neil?" And then Neil shouts back to him from the boat, "More barn."
I want to start yelling "more barn."
More barn is a great thing to yell.
More barn.
All right. Well, nice talking to you guys. Thanks for being on it, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks a lot.
This is so fun. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. All right. Now, Adam White or Ricky Frankel, let's play a tune.
Okay. So I have Oh crap! Where did the notes go? God damn it. Okay. So yeah, I've been a fan of this band for a little while now. Their first album made my 2016 end of the year list. They're called Decent Criminal. They're out of Santa Rosa, California, where I used to kind of live around when I was up in the Bay Area. And they're great. They came out with a new album called Bloom through Dodgeball Records this year. Maybe only a few months ago, but it rocks. Especially if you kind of like the garagier surf punk stuff, like Toy Guitar, I would say. This song is called Deviant. Again, this is by Decent Criminal off their album Bloom. Here it is.
And we're back. That was Decent Criminal doing Deviant. We've got a few last things to cover. First of all, boys,
yeah.
This was a long time in the works.
Everybody
put a lot of work into this, a lot of work, but I think it came out pretty well, although really we're only halfway through or even two-fifths of the way through. So Adam White and Ricky haven't seen the entire fruits of the labor yet. But it's Jello Biafra Week at Punk News. We ran 20 reviews. 5 features, including a double podcast special, 2 interviews with Jello Biafra, and also a short, tiny little blurb from a whole bunch of different artists about why Jello Biafra is cool. Jello Week, it's here. A lot of work, but I'm glad we did it.
Yeah, I wasn't sure what was going on, and then I saw how much work you did with those interviews. Because, I mean, we wrote those reviews like in September or something like that. And I'm like, where is this happening? When's this happening? And then I see like that you had all this stuff planned that no one knew about, and it's just a massive amount of work, John. So I got to tell you, it was a big surprise. And so far, I mean, we're only halfway through, but so far it's going really well. And also I knew this would be cool because I mean, like I said, in the Jello podcast, I'm a huge fan of pretty much everything he's done. And it was cool to review, go back and look at, Plastic Surgery Disasters and Audacity for Hype, at least on my end. So, John, especially that first interview was phenomenal.
Well, thank you, Ricky. Wait till you get the second part of this, or the sequel, if you will.
Sure.
Who's Jello, John?
Eric Reed Bucher, Adam, maybe the most important American punk rocker, if not the most important. Why he would never say he's the most important, and I don't know if I would say he's the most important. I would say he's one of the most important, maybe tied for most important.
Yeah, he's up.
He found a little record label.
Yeah, but then when he left the band, then Travis joined, and then they really kind of kicked in, right?
You know, if he heard you say that, he would probably get furious. an interesting thing about Jello is Jello can be Jello is a very difficult interview because he loves to talk, and you. When you're doing an interview, you kind of have to keep on topic because of the things you want to hit. But also, it's very hard to read Jello. Jello is one of the hardest people to read. Like, he's usually pretty animated, pretty, you know, zah, zah, zah. But sometimes he'll like get like really solemn sounding or annoyed sounding. And it's tough to read. Is he annoyed? Is he sad? Or is he just like thinking, you know? So interviewing Jello can be... I got to say, though... We need to thank Jello a whole lot because Jello is the man. Jello has always been there for Punk News. He's always been down to do interviews. He's always been down for our wacky projects. And Punk News does a lot of wacky projects and a lot of projects that a lot of websites probably wouldn't do. But Jello has always been down. And I got to say, this is a guy that walks the talk. Like, Jello is down. Jello is what he appears to be. Jello is the man. He really is cool. And so we got to thank him. We got to thank Dom Davi, Jesse Townley, Melanie Kay. We got to thank, let me think, who am I missing? Ralph Spite. We got to thank Monica Seed and all the people that contributed. I got to say, Jello is a great person to do a band week for just because his discography is so vast.
The amount of access that he gave you when you approached him to participate in this is pretty amazing. Like, the fact that he sat down and analyzed his whole fucking discography with you is, you know... artists do that, but they do that for the big shot, you know, paid publication kind of thing. Like,
yeah.
people don't do that kind of crap for little old Punk News, let alone Jello Biafra. But fuck, he did. Right. So what are you going to do?
And he did that after a 2-hour interview,
Jesus.
So that story has one of my favorite Punk News comments ever. Under it,
where?
Let me look.
Where they say, and this is a comment directed at John, and it says, "This was really interesting stuff from Jello, but I can't help but think this was just a convenient way to get another Melvin's reference into an otherwise slow Melvin's news week, wasn't it?"
Oh God!
Like, you've orchestrated this whole Jello Biafra week as just an avenue for you to mention the Melvins once or twice.
Maybe they're on to something. You know what I mean? Maybe they're on to something. So listen, man, I love doing band. There are a lot of work, and this one was the most work by far, but I love doing band weeks. The people generally like them. Who do you guys think we should do next? And there's several questions. One of the questions is, maybe we don't need to do a band week. Maybe we can do a person week, you know?
Yeah.
Or maybe do a label week, you know? I'm a little hesitant to do a label week, but I would be down to do another person week, especially a person that's still... See, Jello week was cool because Jello is still doing stuff, but he hasn't put out a record in a couple of years. So, like, now's the perfect time to do it because we can cover his vast discography, but also he's still doing stuff. So it's not like, oh, here's what happened 20 years ago. You know what I mean? It's still a very much today article.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Next. Bye, Ricky.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I know we were talking about doing Ian MacKay.
I was hoping not to turn over our cards, Ricky. But
oh, shit. Sorry. I think someone else talked about it against me, but I think it's too early to do that. I thought, like, I mean, we could. I don't know. I'm actually curious to hear what you guys think because I'm sort of on the fence about it. But we could ostensibly do a Bad Religion week if we wanted to. And yeah, dead silence.
True.
Okay.
We definitely could. Bad Religion would be a great band to do it for because they've got lots of phases. They've got lots of records. They're a big band that people know about. Hypothetically, we could get an interview with some of the BR guys. The problem is I'm just not really a fan. I mean, I'm not a hater. I'm just not a fan. And I'm kind of the guy that directs everything. So, you know, I mean.
No, I'm just throwing names out there. That's all. I mean, I think, but I do think, although I would love to do an Against Me week, I just think it's sort of soon to do that.
Yeah, I mean, for a band that's like, still in the midst of their narrative kind of thing.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to do it. So like you do an Against Me week, but then they'll do something a week later that will, you know, make your whole week of content suddenly seem really old because it doesn't have, you know, this next really important chapter involved in it. I mean, what I think would be cool, and I don't remember which of the Punk News writers suggested this, and I apologize for stealing their idea, would be to do it about like a studio or a producer, right?
Yeah, so that's a good idea.
So like, I mean, the obvious one from the punk rock perspective would be like, or especially from the org core perspective, say, would be the Blasting Room in Fort Collins, Chicago, right? So
yeah.
You got a So you have a studio founded by members of All back in 1994, right? So Bill Stevenson's been running this studio from 94 until now. Ooh. You look at the list of records that have been done at the Blasting Room, there's like a huge amount of them. And that was a stupid comment. Of course, there's many of them, but there's a huge amount of important records. And the only thing that would maybe be a problem about it is, and I guess this wasn't a problem with us doing the Clash or Dead Kennedys or the Ramones or anything, is that it's potentially a lot of records that we've talked about in the past. So we would need to sort of figure out what the angle is on them. But you know, there's a ton of stuff. I would wager to say that most of the stuff that's been recorded at the Blasting Room has been covered on Punk News in one way or another. Like it's that much kind of like on brand with what we do. But maybe that's not so. Maybe that's not the best example because we've talked about it so much already inadvertently. But there's others, right? There's other. You know, you could do your Steve Albini week and talk about you know his stuff. Like I don't know. I think there's some you find one person that's like 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon connected to a whole bunch of cool musical things, but who doesn't normally get the spotlight, and you make it about that. That's what I think we should do.
Hmm.
I think that's an interesting angle and certainly a valid angle. But Adam, what I like doing is I kind of like codifying or almost treating like an important topic in an academic context. Like Clash Week, I thought was really good because we covered not every single Clash release, almost every single Clash release. We had some cool features for Ramones. Well, for Ramones Week, we didn't cover every Ramones Week, but we covered a lot of unique ones. I don't know. I just kind of like focusing and saying, here is the body of knowledge that you can use to get a firm handle on this band.
What we need to do, John, and maybe we haven't done this to the degree that we need to.
Men at Work,
after we've done one of these crazy weeks where you've posted a million reviews and a million things, we really need to go like index these somewhere. If you want to go experience all of Ramones Week, right now, how do you do that?
Well, you said you Google Punk News, hey ho, let's stop, and then
you Google the randomly named article that you cap it with, right? there should be something where the people can go, John, and
indeed,
I don't know what that is.
Because we've got nothing to do at all, we'll get that figured out next. Because we've got nothing to do with Punk News, and we're sitting around twiddling our thumbs. Speaking of a guy that's not twiddling his thumbs, Henry Rollins has left the LA Weekly. It was a bit of a shock, but not that much of a shock. This is the tail end of a very interesting and mysterious story. Last week, all the editors at LA Weekly were fired. There was about three people left at the company, and those people were not editors. And the reason they were fired is because a mysterious new buyer called Manimal Productions or something like that, I forgot the name of the company. I'll look it up in a minute. But a new entity bought LA Weekly, and the weird thing was no one knew who owned the new entity. The new entity was called Seminole Media, but it's spelled incorrectly, which is annoying. So after pressure, Seminole Media revealed who they are. Seminole Media is Brian Kale, formerly of the Southern California News Group. We'll get to him in a minute. Remember that name. Brian Kale, who's right now kind of acting as the publisher for the magazine or the newspaper. David Welch, an LA attorney. Kevin Zhu, a quote, philanthropist and an investor. And whenever someone calls themselves a philanthropist, it means they're pretty much evil. Steve Mayer, an attorney and investor. Paul Macarichian, a boutique-level hotel developer. Mike Mugel, a real estate developer. And Andy Bakur, a Southern California-based investor. surprisingly, they said that they had a possible new investor, Dean Erwin Chemerinsky. Ricky and Adam, do you guys know who Erwin Chemerinsky is?
John, who is this?
This is crazy. Like, my worlds were colliding. This is Chemerinsky is the law school academic. Like, he is the man. He basically, every single student that goes to law school reads Chemerinsky's textbook on constitutional law. He also has several supplements. Chemerinsky is kind of the benchmark, the hallmark, the high standard for what a law school academic should be, what a textbook should be. Like Chemerinsky is the guy when it comes to constitutional law. The Supreme Court reads his opinions before making, well, maybe not now, but until a year ago, the Supreme Court would read his opinions before making their opinion because that's how highly respected he is. Like, it'd be like if I'm trying to think of another like famous academic. It'd kind of be like Neil deGrasse Tyson was investing in something, I guess from the chemistry, from the physics angle, rather. I didn't know Chemerinsky invested in this kind of things, and it's interesting that he's investing in this, namely because Chemerinsky is famously left-leaning. All the other people I mentioned are right-leaning or very far right-leaning. However, it doesn't mean that Chemerinsky is investing. It just means that they threw out his name. I don't know if he is actually investing, or maybe he was just kind of thinking about it, and then they just threw his name out there to make the company look more attractive.
But I mean, like, if you want a comparable example, it'd be like if, say, like Noam Chomsky went and invested in this, because Chomsky, despite the fact that he is, you know, like, well read by people on the left, he is, like, from an academic standpoint, like a linguist, and yeah. And like, linguistics actually factor in a huge amount in computer science. So, like, we studied Chomsky in school for computer science from, like,
really?
That had, like, nothing to do with politics at all. There's actually certain theories that you do in computer science that are named after him. So if you're trying to, like, figure out how to, like, syntactically parse a language down to its individual components, you're using something called Chomsky normal form to do it. So it was really weird, like, when I was in school listening to propaganda, you know, and being involved in all that kind of, like, left-wing Chomsky stuff, and then going to class and I'm, like, learning Chomsky's non-political academia. So anyways, continue.
So anyway, it blew my mind to see Chemerinsky, like, pop up here. Like every law student knows Chemerinsky backwards and forwards. If you don't, you're failing out of law school. It's just so weird for me to, like, see him pop up there. It's like, wow. Anyways, he hasn't invested yet, so I don't think he will. Anyways, so Henry Rollins, they asked him to stay at the paper to continue writing his weekly column. Henry Rollins, in true Rollins style, was very terse about his future plans. He said, "I have decided to leave the LA Weekly. It was a great experience, and I was lucky to work with such talented and dedicated people. Thanks for reading the column." Meanwhile, a lot of the former LA Weekly people are kind of peeved because they got fired out of the blue and surprisingly. And actually, before Seminole bought the company, when they were thinking of buying LA Weekly, Brian Cow, the guy I mentioned previously, he said he's not going to change the editorial bend of the paper whatsoever. And then he fired everybody. So anyway, one of the former the former film critic, April Wolf, she did some research into this guy, Brian Cow, who is now running the LA Weekly. It turns out that he was a officer at the Claremont Institute. I did some Googling myself and determined that Cow worked as vice president of the Claremont Institute and as a congressional aide in the United States House of Representatives. And here's where it gets iffy. The mission statement of the Claremont Institute is the following. The Claremont Institute has identified the principles that will be necessary to defeat progressivism. We teach principles of the American founding and their application today to the brightest young conservative men and women who will, with our help, go on to positions of power and influence government, the courts, academia, and the media. And I got a little skeeved out about this for a couple of reasons. First, it's interesting that you see a very left paper suddenly now a completely conservative paper. But also, I'm a little skeeved out that they were real secretive about it until they got pressure into revealing who they are. And the main guy, his mission statement is to influence people's thoughts. So they're trying to influence people, but sneakily, which really skeeved me out, Adam. Skeeved me out.
Nothing sacred, John. Nothing sacred.
I wasn't surprised by Henry Rollins leaving. I kind of forgot he wrote for them for a little bit. He'll be fine. I mean, if he wants to do a column, someone will pick him up. I mean, I think
Rollins will be okay.
Yeah, like would anyone really be surprised if he struck a deal with, like, Noisy or anything like that?
No, that's a good business idea, Rich. Yeah. Don't give me any idea.
Yeah.
The other thing is, like, again, you know, I think we talked about this in episode or two ago. Like, I don't get this. Why are people buying up, buying into a business that's not doing well? I don't get this. I mean, if the guy wants to, you know, influence how people think, I don't think print is the way to go these days. This stuff it doesn't make sense to me unless there's something else going on that we haven't been told about.
Yeah, I mean, good point. I mean, I didn't even think of it that way. You're right in that influencing people, especially now more than ever, is done through the internet. Twitter.
We talked about it with the Koch brothers, whatever that was. Again, like I don't get this. I don't know why they think this is a good idea.
It does seem like a bad investment.
Yeah.
So I don't actually have. I don't have too much of an answer as to why any of this stuff is changing hands, except that, like, it must make some money and there must be some value in owning it. So I don't know. The thing that I keep hearing about the LA Weekly thing, and I honestly didn't hear about the Rollins thing until I saw it on Punk News, was that
we were the first to post it, Adam.
Well, like, one of the big things that that I've seen in my universe is that I guess, like, so LA Weekly lost, you know, like most of their paid staff, right, when all of this went down, and they started just, like, actively soliciting for free contributions almost right after that. And I mean, like, hey, Punk News is free contributions, so I don't want to talk, you know, too much out of my ass on this, but it seemed a little rich for them to go, like, you know, okay, we're gonna get rid of all these paid people, but now, you know, do it for free, do it for the exposure.
Yeah, well, there is a difference in that LA Weekly is promising you exposure. And they're like, it's good for you to write for LA Weekly. Punk News makes no bones about it. We never say writing for Punk News will get you anything. You know what I mean?
It will probably hurt you.
The funny thing about Punk News is I always envision Punk News as being in our own little world. And the only people that read it are, like, punks, I guess, or the people that we see around our own little world. And then I get kind of not skeeved out, but like I'll be speaking like an editor at some publication that, like, isn't, like, punk at all. They're like, oh yeah, I've read Punk News, or I've read your stuff at Punk News. I'm like, maybe I should have been a little more careful with those typos, you know. You know what I mean?
The internet is strange. It's strange because, like, there used to be, like, a huge gulf between what we did and, like, the professional, because, like, it was us. And then you had and other like, obviously, punk rock publications. You had, like, your, you know, Paste Punk and all those things that were around at the time. And then and then things about other genres, right? You'd have your, like, Lamb Goat or whatever. And then there was this giant gulf. And then on the other side of the gulf, you had, like, Billboard.com and Rolling Stone. And everything made sense. But it's muddy. It's muddy now, John. It seems to the reader that there is not a huge difference between, like, you know, your Punk Newses and your, you know, and you say, like, your Noisies or your whatevers, but
that's good for us.
I suppose, but it means that, like, our adorable shoddiness is put up against people that are actually, like, paying for things and making money. And then I'm worried that reflects poorly on us, because I don't want someone to go, like, well, you know, Noisy can put out this level of quality, why can't you? And we're like, well, you know,
because we put 35 articles on Jello Biafra, not one of the cool Nikes this week, you know.
So anywho, Hank, if you don't want to get paid for something, you can come right from Punk News.
He won't, Adam. I guarantee he won't.
I don't know. Sorry, I derailed that by trying to be funny. John, I actually, Ricky, this is a question for you because you live in LA. So
yeah,
John, fuck you. I don't want to talk to you.
Okay.
LA Weekly is a name publication from my standpoint, in that I am aware of it and know its name and have read stuff that's been on it, and I don't live anywhere near there, but locally, how big a factor is LA Weekly in I don't know, like, the art scene and culture in LA from your standpoint?
It's
I don't know if it's like a leader, but it's definitely it's pretty prevalent. I mean, it's not every show, but I'd say I'd say just maybe every other show I'll hear like some photographer that is shooting for LA Weekly that's there. They seem
That's pretty big if you ask me.
Yeah, I mean listen, they're not the LA Times, but they're still I saw them almost every time I'm at the Fonda Theater. Like I saw them with I saw Against Me there last time, and inevitably there's someone in the photo pit with from LA Weekly. When I saw Pup, there's an LA Weekly photographer that took photos of me. When I went to that Leftover Crack show, that secret one in that Huntington Beach record shop, there was a guy there for LA Weekly. They're all over the place. They get a lot of photographers. And I do see it, you know, being the printed version being sold, you know, just about everywhere. I mean, and yeah, I mean, it's fairly big. I don't really have anything to scale it against. That's the thing.
But like, so let's say like the changes in ownership and the turnover in writers and everything like that.
Yeah.
Like let's worst case scenario it and say that like, you know, oh no, LA Weekly is finished because of bad business decisions or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
How much does that affect shit on the ground?
I think it will. I don't know. I don't know how much because. I think just art, the art scene here in general would probably take a hit because that seems to be the thing that they're big on is like they're not just like at punk shows or anything like that. They go to everything, even as far out as I think they even covered punk rock bowling too, and so I think it would be a hit. There are other things I read. There are others magazines that are kind of in that realm too, so maybe one would take over if LA Weekly were to kind of like capsize. I write for one of them on the side, and so I think there's I guess looking back now, there's sort of like they do kind of hold like the number one place in that realm. They seem to be, it's weird because it's like they're local here, but they seem to have a pretty national presence. So, I don't know how really it looks to everyone else. They usually have like good photos of like festivals and stuff like that, but I don't know if is that any more that you guys, do you guys hear anything more about it?
Well, I feel that like over the years, there's been a lot of, let's say like interviews or features or things like that, that they've done that Punk News has picked up and talked about. And it may just be, and I can't tell from where I am if it's just because of their particular proximity to all those Californian punk labels that we had talked about for so many years, or if it's more that they're just like geographic region aside, just a major arts voice. And I've never quite been able to square that.
Yeah, I think that's kind of where I'm landing too now, because I mean they are big here, like the people, like, yeah, they are big. But I don't know, and they have clout. I kind of am where you are now. I'm not really sure though. But they seem to have a good amount of clout here.
All right, John, what are we doing now?
Well, we're clouting it up and playing a tune, Adam White. We're flexing our clout by playing the tunes people want to hear. Well, the tunes we want to hear.
Is it me? Because I haven't done any prep for this.
I thought you had a song.
I didn't. Like,
well, listen, Adam's going to play something, and we'll come back and we'll wrap it up. We got so much clout, we don't even know what we're going to play before we play it. That's how much clout we have. And I'm just using the word clout completely incorrectly, just because it makes me sound like I know what I'm talking about. This is a song, Clout It Out.
Ah.
And we're back. Right.
Hold on. Just hold. I will find out what the song actually is so that we.
Wait, I use clout correctly, from right?
You use clout correctly. Okay, yes.
Because now I'm all paranoid because you're saying it so much.
wasted your time. Nobody's fault but mine, and I just don't care. So well intended, and you're so fucking smart. Tell me why you can't be happy. I should have known right from the start. This shame is never ending. Make me feel so fucking small. Let's just keep on pretending. Let's see how far we fall. It's nobody's fault but mine. I know I wasted your time. Nobody's fault but mine, and I just don't care. Nobody's fault but mine. I know I wasted your time. Nobody's fault but mine, and I just don't care. I just don't care. I just don't care. I just don't care.
All right, John, we didn't announce it beforehand, but that song was called Just Don't Care. It was by a band from Vancouver, BC called the Corner Boys. This is a three piece that plays this incredibly, well, you guys just heard it, 70s authentic, early sound in punk rock. This is a three piece. The vocalist is the drummer, a guy by the name of Patrick Bertrand, who used to, or it's not used to, still does, run the Hosehead Records label. He's joined to that band by Joel Butler of the band Nervous Talk, and Wade from the now defunct band Stress Eating. So they just had a three song, I think, 7-inch called Just Don't Care. This was the title track from it that came out on the UK's Drunken Sailor Records. So, if you like, you know, really, really authentic-y, you know, Buzzcocks-y sound and punk, these guys get as close to the mark as you can get. So, John, are we wrapping up? Do we have anything else to do?
We got a lot to do, but I think we got to wrap this episode up. It was a jam-packed episode. We spoke to Early Riser. We talked about Jello. We talked about the intricacies of the LA Weekly. I'm just treading water here, Adam. Just treading water.
Well, all right. Email us, podcast@punknews.org. That's how you do it. We got to get John out of the pool before he gets all wrinkly. So talk to you later.
This has been a Velour Underground production. I am Greg Simpson, producer of this podcast. Hit me up if you want me to mix, master, or produce your podcast, even from afar. Or you got a band you want to come record with me in scenic Lafayette, Indiana? Let's do it. Hit me up at greg@velourundergroundstudios.com.